Welcome everyone, aloha, howdy all. We are live from East Tennessee. I'm very happy that you could join me. We have a very special webinar today. We are going to be looking at some really fascinating issues, and it's all coming to a head. And we have a really big audience from all over the world. This is our biggest webinar to date, and I think it's because everyone feels something is about to happen. You'll feel it, I feel it. Something big is about to unveil itself. And for everyone that's joining in, I congratulate you because you're ahead of the crowd. You are the ones that are preparing yourselves. In many of your cases, like me, this is something that you've been waiting for all your life. There is a part of you that knew that you were here for a special purpose. And I think what we are about to witness is going to be so profound, so life-changing. There's going to be a lot of people around the planet, in our communities, in our families, in our workplace, that aren't going to have a clue about what is about to unveil itself. And so you are going to be the ones that are going to introduce them to this material. You're going to be the ones that red pill them into something that, other than movies, they have no idea about the magnitude of what it is to happen. So we are going to do a deep dive into the whole issue of space arcs, cedar civilizations, and the great reveal that is about to unveil itself. Now,
you're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
What is it about these arcs that makes them so relevant today? These space arcs that we're going to be looking at. In history, we've had references to arcs, and one of the oldest references is the Sumerian flood legend. And that civilization, Sumeria or Sumer, really began overnight almost around 3,800 BC. So almost 6,000 years ago, this Sumerian civilization just happened overnight. And one of the earliest records was referring to this great flood that occurred prior to this emergence of Sumer around 3,800 BC. And the hero of this flood story was a bloke named Utnapishtim. And Utnapishtim, he was helped by a Sumerian god, Enki, or also known as Ea in Akkadian and Babylonian mythology. And so the story in the flood legend was that the gods decided to punish humanity for their sins, for malfeasance. And of all the gods, Enki was the one that was wanting to protect humanity, to keep the human experiment running. And so he told Utnapishtim to walk away from all of his worldly possessions and to build a huge ship called the Preserver of Life. And so Enki helped Utnapishtim build this ark. And so in the descriptions of the ark that Enki helped Utnapishtim build, it was made of solid timber, so it was said the rays of Shamas, the sun, wouldn't shine in, so it was something that was really waterproof. And of equal dimensions in length and width, the god Enki assisted with the design and the construction of the Preserver of Life. The building of the ship took 5 days. So you kind of like think about it. 5 days to build a wooden ark that would hold thousands of people. I mean, even with the help of this god, Enki, who today we would refer to as one of the Anunnaki, a extraterrestrial, I mean, that would be quite a task if it was just being built by wood. So that suggests that something else was going on, that this was no ordinary ark built with wood that was fully submersible so that it wouldn't be able to, so that the sun wouldn't be able to penetrate, and that it could hold thousands of animals. Something else was going on here. Then we have the legend of Noah's Ark in the Bible. And similar story, really it's a derivation of the Sumerian flood story. And you have a hero, Noah, and he's being commanded by God or Yahweh, or the Elohim, to build this ark. And again, it's depicted as a wooden ark, as something very large that would hold thousands of people. And so here's a description of the ark, roughly 510 feet long, 85 feet wide, 51 feet high, several thousand animals, and it would be able to last for a year. Now, you know, clearly, if we're talking about something that could house 1,000 animals and the family of Noah for a year, we're talking about something massive. And of course, in the story of Noah's Ark, it's just described as this very long wooden boat. And here's a modern-day reconstruction in northern Kentucky that depicts what Noah's Ark would have looked like based on biblical texts and references. So was the ark just this very long wooden boat built very quickly by Noah, by Utnapishtim, and other places in the world? Because the ark legends are worldwide. You find them, there are actually over 270 flood stories, and those flood stories refer to these arks that preserved humanity, or parts of humanity, families, and animals, two of each kind, that would be used to reseed the population. So this was a story that was all-pervasive. So it suggests that there was something very real historically here, but was it really just about this wooden ark, very large boat that could hold animals and float on the surface of the ocean during a great flood? Well, we get to get an answer from different sources. Now, one of these sources is the remote viewing that's conducted on a regular basis by the Farsight Institute. And they look at historical events. And recently I did an interview on my YouTube channel with the founder of the Farsight Institute, Dr. Courtney Brown. And he talked about the temporal aspect of remote viewing. And so one of their temporal projects was to look at Noah's Ark and find out, well, was this just a wooden boat built by Noah and his family to house a lot of people, to house a lot of animals and his family? Well, the result from the remote viewing was that it wasn't just a wooden boat. And this is the result, according to Courtney Brown, from the data that the remote viewers gave. There was a great flood and an ark filled with animals, and there was a Noah fellow and a subject who Noah thought was God. However, after that, the story dramatically diverges from the legends as found in ancient texts. The ark itself was in fact a very large, high-tech structure, a spaceship that was mostly submerged underwater at the time of the flood. So we're talking not about a wooden boat, but we're talking about a spacecraft, a space ark that preserved Noah and his family, that preserved all those thousands of animals for a period of time during which the floodwaters would recede. So this is our first answer, that these space arks do exist. Now, another source is Dolores Cannon, and for those of you who haven't read her books, The Convoluted Universe, I highly recommend it. I think Dolores Cannon was a real pioneer in getting data using this hypnotic regression where she would look at the past lives of people. And she was able to look at the past lives of many hundreds, even thousands of individuals, and was able to discern distinct patterns. And based on that, she was able to write quite a series of books. And so she was a pioneer, and her work is very, very valuable for those of us that want to understand what really happened in the ancient past. Because we know what's happening recently, because we have documents, we have historical records, we have eyewitness reports of contemporary events, but things that happened thousands of years ago, you know, there's remote viewing, and then there's past life hypnotic regression that can give us more data on what it is that happened. So here's a video clip, or sorry, an audio clip from her book, the audio version of The Convoluted Universe. It runs for about 3 minutes, and you get to hear what type of arc it was that saved humanity and the animals in prior civilizations. So let's listen to that.
I see ships, alien ships. They're coming down. It creates fear, but they're not hostile.
He described the ships as
sort of round, but not ball-shaped, more oval. They're not little two or three man things. They're bigger. They can hold many people.
The ships were not landing, but hovering over the ground.
And all the people from many villages are here.
What happens?
We have to leave. Everybody has to go in the ship.
Why would you have to leave? This is your home.
Because something's going to happen. And if we don't leave, we'll be killed. Me and this woman and other people from other villages are going to help lead them on these ships. We're trying to round them up. Some go willingly. They're willing to follow. And others, you have to encourage them. They think it's crazy.
I asked for a description of the inside of the ship after everyone was on board.
It is good size. There's room for everybody, and it's not crowded.
You said there are several ships?
Yes, in different places. You can look in the distance and see them. You can take stuff with you if you want, or animals, and whatever you think.
Can you see the people that have come with the ship? What do they look like?
They're trying to look non-threatening. They're trying to smile and hold out their hand and be friendly. Be careful of who they approach.
Do they look human?
Yes.
Just ask them what's going on down there.
Just planetary changes that you wouldn't understand. It's kind of a cross between a volcano and a comet and a nuclear explosion. That's the closest he can describe that I can understand. They knew it was coming, and that's why they wanted to take as many people off as they could. And we'll go back.
Will you go back right away?
He starts to explain that we can be held in a situation where time goes by, but we don't change. And then we'll just go back.
That's an interesting way to put it. Time will go by, but you won't change. Can he explain it any better?
It's not suspended animation. Time will go by, but you won't... How do I explain it? Time goes by on Earth. Time does not go by on the ship. The Earth will go through stuff, and the ship won't.
Are they going to keep you on the ship until it's time to go back?
Right. It's not going to be very long.
But on Earth, it would be much longer.
Yes.
So you won't go anywhere else? You just stay on the ship?
Just hover.
That answered the question I had earlier. I thought they would have to be taken somewhere where they could wait out a catastrophe and not be able to return until the Earth was capable of supporting life again, which could be thousands of years. If they were not trapped by the concept of time, it would be rather like watching the events like a fast-forward on a videotape.
That is good that it will not take that long, because the people won't get that upset. There is plenty of room, so some of them brought their animals with them. It's like a Noah's Ark.
That's what I was thinking. It sounded like it.
We won't feel like it's a long time on the ship.
So there you have a really important account of what happened in prior civilizations when these arcs were deployed. You had the Earth about to undergo some cataclysmic events, the arcs appear, ovoid-shaped spacecraft, and people are taken into the craft, and animals, and they're taken off planet for what appears to them to be a short time, but in the meantime, on the Earth, there could be many years, even centuries passing because of the temporal displacement when you are in these space-time devices. So the people only spent what to them what might be a day or a couple of days on these arcs, but centuries passed on the Earth until the Earth restored itself to a way in which life was sustainable again. And so you have these extraterrestrials that were responsible for the space arcs, picking individuals from amongst humans to be the intermediaries with the rest of humanity who otherwise would have been very frightened about what was happening. So that's a very compelling account of historical events that took place in the long forgotten memories of humanity that could only be accessed through these innovative techniques like past life regression, that shows that these arcs were not wooden boats that floated on the surface of the oceans or of floodwaters, but in fact were spacefaring craft that were able to move through space-time. So that was Dolores Cannon, and her information really confirms what we got from the remote viewing of Noah's Ark from Courtney Brown's Farsight Institute, that the legendary arcs are in fact extraterrestrial spacecraft. And there's another source that also supports this. There was a CIA remote viewing done of Mars just before the cataclysm, and the remote viewers were told to look at Mars prior to cataclysmic events that led to the end of life on the surface of Mars. So what happened for the end days of Mars? So I wrote an article on exopolitics.org, and that's the title of it, and you can read about that remote viewing experiment and get all the citations from that particular article. But I wanted to read one of the extracts from that remote viewing that actually involved a monitor, and the subject is the remote viewer. And we know later on, we learned that that actually was Joseph McMonagall, who's a very famous remote viewer. So in this remote viewing session, this is what the monitor asked Joseph McMonagall. Okay, when the others left, these people are waiting. When the others left, how did they go? So subject, that's McMonagall, and he's just responding to questions about the targets that he got to remote view. So he wasn't told anything about this is remote viewing Mars just before its collapse. He was just given an alphanumeric target, you know, target 15B67, something like that. And this is the information he got. And so the monitor was asking him questions about what he was observing. And so this is how McMonagall responded to that question. Get an impression of, don't know what the hell it is. It looks like the inside of a larger boat. Very rounded walls and shiny metal. So something round, an ovoid, and shiny metal. So this is not a wooden boat. This is an ovoid-shaped craft similar to what was described in the Dolores Cannon material, where you have hypnotic regression being used to get information about these ancient space arcs. And McMonagall, the monitor asks, go along with them on their journey and find out where it is they go. Impression of a really crazy place with volcanoes and gas pockets and strange plants. Very volatile place. It's very much like going from the frying pan into the fire. Difference is there seems to be a lot of vegetation where the other place did not have it, and different kind of storm. So what is being described here is that as the ancient Martians boarded this space arc, leaving their world as it's going through cataclysms and storms and so forth, they go to another world which is very volcanic, full of vegetation and quite hot. And that is clearly Earth in a very volcanic region. So what that is telling us is that these space arcs were used to evacuate the ancient Martians to Earth at a time when their civilization collapsed tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years ago. We don't know exactly the date when that happened. So another source referring to these spacecraft. So now the question that arises is, well, who built them? Who built the space arcs? So this is where we go into the material of Phyllis Schlemmer and the Council of Nine. Now, she wrote her book, The Only Planet of Choice, that comprised her channelings of the Council of Nine back in 1993, and that was a compilation of 20 years of channeling that really began in 1973 when she was working with Dr. Andrea Puharich, MD, and his approach to remote viewing or to channeling was very interesting because he used a Faraday cage. And this was something that kind of set him apart from others that were doing channeling because he was a professional paranormal researcher. And for him, channeling was a scientific enterprise. And so the best way in which to conduct a scientific experiment was to create control conditions that would exclude outside factors. And so the Faraday cage was one of the ways that he thought he could do this. So in terms of understanding the Council of Nine, I just want to briefly mention a little bit about Puharich and his communications with the Council of Nine that began in December of 1952. So we're going back 70 years now to this very important time when we have paranormal research just beginning around the same time as the whole extraterrestrial issue is being handled by the military intelligence community in the United States and elsewhere around the world. So this is how it looked. A Faraday cage is a metallic cage that completely surrounds a person or an object, and it protects it from outside electromagnetic energy that cannot penetrate the cage itself because the wavelength is too big to pass through that mesh. So this is how a Faraday cage looks. And so Puharich put his channelers in these Faraday cages and he was able to measure how well they were able to not only receive telepathic communications, but also how well they were able to do paranormal research. So this was something that got the attention of the Pentagon and the CIA back in 1953, because they were very interested in the whole paranormal research phenomenon. They were very interested in psychic abilities. And so here you had someone like Dr. Puharich, who was getting really interesting results. So the CIA and the Pentagon really got interested in what he was doing. And the Pentagon got so interested that they actually recruited Puharich, which was very unusual because Puharich had served in the Second World War and he had received a medical discharge. So after he began his paranormal research, the Army said, oh, we need you to work for us. And to do that, we're going to conscript you again, even though he had a medical discharge. And so they conscripted him again. So this is the way in which the Pentagon could control Puharich. And the CIA got also involved because they were very interested in how psychic research and paranormal could be weaponized or could be used for intelligence gathering purposes. So this is where we get into a lot of controversy about the Council of Nine and Andrea Puharich, because according to a book authored by Lynn Picnic and Clive Prince that came out in 2001, they said that Puharich's research and his work with the Council of Nine was really a product of CIA psychological warfare. that there is no Council of Nine, that it's just a PSYOP. So that comes from the Stargate conspiracy. And there were others that really parroted what Picnic and Prince said. And I first read this book around 2004, 2005. And at that time, I didn't really know too much about Buharic and the Council of Nine. And so I just kind of like thought, well, you know, these guys put out a well-researched work and it seemed to be very scholarly in how it analyzed the Council of Nine and the relationship between the CIA and Buharic and the Pentagon. And so I kind of like accepted at the time that, well, you know, maybe this is really a product of a psychological operation. But in doing research for my most recent book, which is going to be coming out at the end of this month or beginning of next month, I actually got to dive more deeply into this controversy over Buharic, over the Council of the Nine, and found out that, in fact, this work, the Stargate Conspiracy, is deeply flawed. It really makes false assumptions based on guilt by association. In other words, they operated by the premise, well, because Buharic was working with the CIA or working with the Pentagon, or that the Pentagon and the CIA were interested in Buharic and Buharic collaborating to a certain extent, then he is guilt by association. He's part of a psychological operation. Well, in fact, it's the opposite. It was because Buharic was real that the paranormal research was getting excellent results, that these communications with the Council of Nine were really providing detailed information about extraterrestrials. That's why the Pentagon got involved. That's why the CIA got involved, because this is how you can get information about extraterrestrials from the perspective of an intelligence gathering unit or from the Department of Defense. Okay. All right, so that's it. So that's the kind of a little bit of the history of the Council of Nine, Buharic, and the controversy over him. Now some of you will say, well, you know, I mean, do we trust Picnic and Prince, or do we trust Sala's analysis, you know, his revision of what he had earlier thought? What I think is going to be very helpful for you to make up your own mind is if you go to the raw material, because the raw material I know is regarded very, very highly in the exopolitical community, in the New Age community, because of the work people like David Wilcock and others have been doing, because the raw material is very, very consistent. Now, the raw material, Ra was actually asked, is the Council of Nine and Buharic real? Are they genuine, or is it a psychological operation? And this is, they addressed that question at several points, but this is essentially what they said. Quote, the council operates by means of what you would call telepathic contact with the oneness or unity of the nine, the distortions blending harmoniously so that the law of one prevails with ease. So that was the law of one session on January 25th, 1980s. Well, actually, that date I think should be 1983. That was my mistake. So that's 1983. So the raw material is saying that the Council of Nine is genuine. So hopefully that helps you reach your own decision. But I'm just going to present the data to you and what I think is going on. At the end of the day, you have to decide for yourself what information you're going to accept as real or not. But I think that the Council of Nine material is accurate. So now we move over to the extraterrestrial seeders. Who are the seeders? So who actually built these space arcs? Because the Council of Nine gives answers to this. In The Only Planet of Choice, this is really the first documented response to what it is that was involved in the construction of these space arcs that appear again and again in human history to rescue people as one age collapses or ends and another age is about to begin. So this book presents the first discussion of 24 extraterrestrial civilizations that seeded humanity with diverse genetics in many races and ethnicities. So we have a multiplicity of races and ethnicities on the planet. That's not accidental. In fact, that is a result of 24 extraterrestrial civilizations with distinct genetic differences and cultures between them seeding humanity. That accounts for the diversity, according to the Council of Nine material. So this is what is written in the Only Planet of Choice. Quote, in relationship to us, there are 24 physical civilizations in another dimensional realm. Each is a total collective consciousness that oversees, and from these civilizations, physical beings have incarnated upon your planet Earth and at times have intervened when necessary. Very important. So these extraterrestrial civilizations, the 24 of them, have been involved in overseeing the establishment of distinct civilizations on planet Earth, that they have physically incarnated amongst us and have intervened when necessary. So think about what you heard earlier with Dolores Cannon and those space arcs that rescued the people just before a great catastrophe was about to emerge. So this passage is telling us pretty much the same thing, that this was an intervention by one of the 24 extraterrestrial civilizations that rescued the people, and that they do intervene. So what this is telling us is that the ancient builders of the space arcs were these 24 extraterrestrial civilizations. So who were they? Who were these civilizations? In the Only Planet of Choice, we're told that the civilizations included Altea, which is an extraterrestrial civilization that was responsible for the seeding and establishment of Atlantis. So this is what it says in the Only Planet of Choice. An example would be the civilization of Altea. As we are in another realm of existence, we depend on Altea for communicating with you. They guard the body of our being while you are in communication with us, and they provide the technology for us to communicate. Altea was also the head of what you know as the physical civilization that manifested upon planet Earth as Atlantis. So this is telling us that the Council of Nine are essentially these disembodied, higher dimensional spiritual entities that communicate with those that are receptive to that higher level of communication. But they don't have physical bodies per se. They need an intermediary, an extraterrestrial civilization that does have physical bodies, that can provide protection, that can provide technology so that they could share what it is that they need to communicate. Now remember, at the very beginning, this was all happening with a Faraday cage. So this was part of the technological protection that was being provided, and Poharich was working with one of these groups, I believe. So this is Altea, and they were the ones that established the physical civilization of Atlantis. And earlier on I mentioned Enki and the Anunnaki. Well, we can see them as being one of these 24 extraterrestrial civilizations that established the civilization of Sumeria, or Sumer, if you like. Another civilization is Huva, the Hebrews. And in the Bible, are there these stories, and it might not be so much the Bible, but I think more in these ancient Jewish traditions, I think they call it the Talmud or the Torah, excuse me, I mix those up all the time. But they have stories about King Solomon, who had these incredibly advanced technologies. Well, what kind of technologies were these? Flying saucer craft, anti-gravity, new free energy devices. The ancient Hebrews had these kinds of advanced technologies, but they were protected. They weren't disseminated to the whole population, because these advanced technologies, the pattern after the Great Flood was that these technologies would only be used by very select numbers within any civilization. So King Solomon was one of those. So the ancient Hebrews had this. And this is what the Only Planet of Choice had to say about the Hebrews. There are amongst you incumbent souls from those civilizations who have come to help planet Earth. One of these civilizations, Hoover, was the civilization that originally seeded planet Earth, as did some of the others. But Hoover reseeded planet Earth on three occasions. Hoover is the civilization from which the Hebrews derive, hence the importance of the Hebrews. Hoover is the civilization that brought forth the Nazarene. So it says that the Hoover reseeded planet Earth on three occasions. So if you look at the ancient Bible, Noah's generation and those that preceded him, Methuselah, Jared, Enoch, they were from an earlier civilization. After Noah, you had another civilization, or this was the receding, the Hebrew civilization that's associated with Moses. So that is really considered the third receding of the planet Earth. And I think it's kind of worth acknowledging here that, you know, I've mentioned in earlier webinars that there has been a temporal war happening on planet Earth for many thousands of years. So, you know, based on this, we can understand now why it is that the Hebrews were targeted by the Nazis, because the Hebrews carried the genetic markers of this Hoover civilization, and the Nazis were working with the Draco reptilians, and they wanted to eliminate that genetic marker, because that genetic marker is essential for the Hoover civilization to be able to work with humanity. So this is why the Nazis were so determined on removing them. Hitler was taking his marching orders from the Dracos. Interestingly, Hoover was the civilization that brought forth the Nazarene. They're talking about Jesus. Now, Jesus was a very special individual. Now, you know, there's a lot of debate about, you know, was Jesus just a normal human, son of God? Was he an extraterrestrial starseed? But one of the things I really was impressed with was that Jesus carried this extraordinarily powerful love vibration. And that was unique because that was something that was new at that time. And it was made possible because of these genetic markers that are provided by the Hoover civilization, according to the Council of Nine Materials. So very, very interesting. Now, one of the very fascinating aspects about the Council of Nine and its information was the involvement of Gene Roddenberry. Now, Gene Roddenberry was involved with the Council of Nine because he had been working with US Navy intelligence for a long time. I mean, I have actually, in one of my earlier presentations or several presentations in my books, I've described how the US Navy intelligence actually approached Roddenberry in the mid-1960s and told him about the Navy's secret space program and got them to work with him. So got him to work with them so that he could be part of a soft disclosure to prepare humanity for a future when the existence of a Navy secret space program would be revealed to the rest of humanity. So Roddenberry knew about the Navy secret space program in the mid-1960s, and from his Navy sources, he was told that the channeling information that Paharich was receiving through the Council of Nine that Phyllis Schlemmer was involved with was accurate. And so he got involved in that. So Roddenberry, and this is a fact, attended Council of Nine channeling sessions in 1974-1975 in Ossining, New York. And he did ask many questions. And these questions are recorded in the book Only Planet of Choice. And so he was very fascinated by the extraterrestrial seeders, and he asked a lot of questions about them. Who are they, and what are they doing, and how are they going to get involved? So this is one of the questions he had. Gene, you mentioned that at some stage there might be a large-scale landing of the civilizations. What method of transportation would be used in such a landing? Are we referring to physical vehicles? Tom, and that's the Council of Nine, he's the spokesperson. Yes, that would be the nature of what you would call a physical vehicle. So this is confirmation that the 24 civilizations are moving around our galaxy or between galaxies in spacecraft. So Gene and Roddenberry went on. Can you tell me anything about the relative size and shape and so on? Would they hold a large number of people? Tom, There would be vehicles of different sizes and different designs. There would be some with the appearance of a glass top, but it is not in truth a top. It will just have its appearance. There will be also those that will remain in your atmosphere that are very large, that will then send out smaller ones. So he's talking about motherships that can hold large numbers of people, and that their design is similar to a glass top. Well, we're talking like a flying saucer or an ovoid-shaped craft. So this is not new. In 1952, George Adamski showed one of these motherships hovering over the hovering between the Earth and the Moon, actually over the Moon, and you could see scout craft coming out of this cigar-shaped craft. So this is the famous series of photographs that George Adamski took back in March 5th, 1952. And you can see it's very, very compelling. It's right there. Now, yeah, this is where there's so much dishonesty when it comes to the UFO research community. Because I always say about contactees, you know, where's the evidence for your claim? You know, you say you went up on a spacecraft. Where's the evidence? So Adamski had evidence. He had photographs. He provided them. And then they, you know, they dismiss that evidence. But here's compelling evidence of a mothership with spacecraft in the atmosphere above the Moon with scout craft coming out of it. So we know this is happening, and according, so this is confirmation for what Roddenberry was being told back in 1974. So Roddenberry went on. This is the response he got from the Council of Nine. It is of great importance for you to understand that your governments of your world of Earth have refused to publicly believe or convey to the people our existence. If there were an attempt by civilizations to land upon planet Earth in a mass situation, which in truth will come to pass in the course of time, the people upon planet Earth would panic, for they have not the understanding, the knowledge that we would mean no harm to them. So this is why it's so damaging that there has been no disclosure. Because there are multiple extraterrestrial civilizations out there that have been visiting the Earth. But there are some very benevolent ones that are part of the creation of not just our present-day civilization, but have been involved with the seeding of planet Earth multiple times, going back hundreds of thousands of years, with multiple civilizations. So just imagine the wisdom. Imagine the detailed knowledge that they could share with us and the technologies they could share. But the governments hide that. The militaries hide that. And of course, there's even opposition to the extraterrestrial seeders, or these 24 civilizations arriving. The only planet of choice, it goes on. Those lesser civilizations who have been viewing planet Earth, who have made contact with governments, and who are in portion in beings upon planet Earth, and in this realm as well, would have warlike conflict with the 24 civilizations, or those who work with them. Therefore, that would mean a destructive device in the atmosphere of planet Earth. Humankind, in its great fear, would not have acknowledged or understood that there were those of goodness also. So if the 24 civilizations, if the seeders just revealed themselves, because people say, well, why don't they just reveal themselves? The problem would be that, as Roddenberry was told at that time, that these lesser civilizations, the Greys, the Reptilians, the Orions, would also reveal themselves. They would start shooting and create chaos and pandemonium, and people wouldn't know who's good, who's bad. Are we being attacked? Are they here to help us? People would be confused, and so this was a major consideration that the extraterrestrial seeders had to take into account before they appeared. And back at that time, in the early 1970s, there was a plan for them to reveal themselves. And that plan led to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the movie. That was really a soft disclosure initiative. That was to prepare humanity for this announcement of the seeders. So this was a White House initiative Spielberg, he was being fed information by white hats within the military intelligence community to put out this movie to prepare humanity for the arrival of the Cedars. Unfortunately, it didn't happen for the reasons that I described earlier, that the military intelligence community understood that if the Cedars showed up in the late 1970s, as the plan required, that other extraterrestrials would start also appearing, begin shooting, creating chaos, and there would be pandemonium and humanity wouldn't be ready for it. So the plan was delayed. So that was, say, in the 1970s, late 70s. So we're talking nearly 50 years ago, there was a plan for the 24 extraterrestrial civilizations to reveal themselves, but that plan was aborted at the last minute because the White Hats felt that there wasn't enough awareness or support for the extraterrestrials showing up without other extraterrestrial groups creating pandemonium through attacking and just making it look as though the Earth was under attack. So Gene Roddenberry's notes on the Cedar's arrival was used for a TV series. So Roddenberry was very influenced by the Council of Nine in a number of ways. I mean, the TV series Deep Space Nine was very influenced by the channeling sessions because he was trying to put out information about the Council of Nine that are depicted in Deep Space Nine as the prophets living inside the wormhole. So those are, in fact, that is the Council of Nine. That is how Roddenberry wanted to depict them. And also there was another series that Roddenberry put together that depicted the arrival of the Cedars. And this is called Earth, the Final Conflict, that ran for 5 seasons. Gene Roddenberry was attributed as the series creator because he died in 1991, but his notes, I mean, he wrote the pilot episode, his notes were used for this series. And this depicts the arrival of not just one, but several extraterrestrial civilizations and how humanity would adjust to that. So there are other sources that talk about the arrival or the existence of multiple extraterrestrial civilizations helping humanity. Alex Collier, he in the early 1990s learned from his Andromedan contacts about multiple extraterrestrial civilizations seeding humanity in remote antiquity and running at least 22 genetic experiments. So this is, of course, a completely different source to the Council of Nine material that I mentioned earlier. And this is coming from the Andromeda Council that Alex Collier worked with. And he was told about 22 genetic experiments. And so that's at least, so that's pretty close to what we were told, that there were 24 extraterrestrial civilizations that are running these genetic experiments according to the only planet of choice. So this is what Alex said in Defending Sacred Ground. We, as a product of extraterrestrial genetic manipulation, are possessors of a vast gene pool consisting of many different racial memory banks, also consisting of at least 22 different races. Because of our genetic heritage and because we are spirit, the benevolent extraterrestrial races actually view us as being royalty. So he is identifying that not only have there been a multiplicity of extraterrestrial civilizations that have been involved in the genetic engineering of humanity going back tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, but this genetic diversity actually makes us royalty, according to the Andromeda Council. Yeah, and this is something very important to understand because, you know, for those of us that read the literature, when we immerse ourselves in literature coming from groups such as the Draconians or the Greys, humanity is depicted as kind of almost stupid, easily manipulated and easily controlled. But in fact, from a higher dimensional perspective, from extraterrestrial civilizations that are part of the seeders, humanity is genetic royalty because we have within us this incredible potential if we ever learned to use it. So some groups try to dumb us down so that we can be controlled, while other groups like the Andromedans, like the Council of Nine, the Confederation of Planets, and other organizations try to uplift humanity so that we can access the incredible DNA and genetic information we have within us and the abilities we have. So now I'm going to move to one of my other sources, and that is JP, who I've known since 2008 when he first had extraterrestrial contact. That happened in Brazil, and he contacted me soon afterwards. And he just contacted me out of the blue and introduced himself, and so we began talking, and I've been working on his case since then. Now, what's interesting about him is that in 2014, he began telling me about these large hemisphere-shaped arcs that he traveled to, that he was taken on them, and he said he saw these were huge arcs. He described them as massive arcs that had lots of animals on them, that had lots of plants, lots of vegetation. He said that some of these plants, some of these animals were extinct on Earth, but he said that they were being preserved. And he said that when he went on these arcs, he was being told that in the future, he would be brought back on one of these arcs, and that this would be used to establish a future civilization. That was a possibility. Now, one of the things about JP is that what makes him very interesting is that he's actually given me dozens of photographs and some video of anti-gravity spacecraft photographed near MacDill Air Force Base in 2017 and 2018. And I have a webpage on exopolitics.org where I have a lot of articles where you can look at some of these photos. And here's one of the articles where you can actually see a flying rectangle and a flying triangle photographed next to each other near MacDill Air Force Base, home of US Special Operations Command. And the kicker in all of this was that JP, and that's a pseudonym because he's currently working with the US Army, the kicker was that he was actually prodded to take the photographs by covert military personnel that wanted him to take the photographs and release them to the public. So he was part of this covert disclosure initiative that I describe in many of my articles. So, as I mentioned, he was being encouraged to take photographs by these covert operatives and to release them into the public arena. And they began working with him because, unlike what official government agencies tend to suggest, they take a very strong interest in extraterrestrial contactees. Now, extraterrestrial contactees, they get they are widely ridiculed and attacked. People in the UFO community are some of the most vociferous critics of contactees. And the military intelligence community kind of like prods that. But secretly, they get these contactees to come in and to give debriefings because they want to find out what are the ETs up to. So JP was working with covert military personnel since 2008, and that's why they chose him to release this information. So here's some documentation. People always want to know, is he really US Army? Is he just making it up? He doesn't sound like US Army. Well, so I thought I'd release some of his documentation with his name blanked out. So here's the certificate of affiliation that shows that he passed all of the training to be part of the US Army Ordnance Corps. So that was the training he underwent soon after undergoing basic training in January 2020 when he joined. So you know, that's part of his military occupation specialty, or MOS. So he's ordnance and chemical engineer, or chemical repairer, ordnance and chemical repairer. So that's his day job in the military. But he's also got a kind of a side job where he's been trained in special forces. So he has been given training in special forces, and so he shows that he's trained with U.S. Army Rangers. So that's his. So this is of him. So that little badge shows that he's completed the courses for the parachute division with the U.S. Army. So JP has gone through this training, and that's because people within the covert military wanted JP to get this training because they wanted him to be part of these covert off-world missions. Because they want contactees to be part of these missions, because contactees have special genetics. They have the right stuff, if you like. Not everyone has the genetics. So it's all about genetics. I mean, people often think, well, if you want to get involved in covert operations, it's about your skill set and all of that. Well, that's partly the answer, but the big factor is genetics. If you've got the right genes, all the doors open up and you get fast-tracked into very senior positions. And so JP has been fast-tracked into these positions. So JP, in September 21st, he started to say that he was told by human-looking extraterrestrial to prepare for a mission to Jupiter's moon Ganymede to meet an incoming fleet of highly evolved extraterrestrial visitors, the seeders, extraterrestrial seeders. So that's the article I wrote about JP's information and what happened when JP went on this mission later. So it's a series of articles, actually, because he was first told about the mission that was coming up. I put out this article where you can read about it. And then later on, JP got back to me and told me what happened during the mission. So this is what he said after he got back from the mission. So I'll just play this audio clip now. In your Skype message, you said that the ships, or what it was that was found, got activated after the ships came in to our solar system. So can you explain that?
Well, we had these massive ships that came in our solar system, and they're still in the vicinity of Jupiter. And after these ships got there, we think they're other ships, but we're not sure yet. They're deep inside, and they're warming up the surrounding areas.
Okay, and so they're big, and they're kind of like just buried under the surface of the moon.
The moon and Antarctica is warming up also, and also...
So you have JP talking about these fleets of craft arriving and other craft that have been lying dormant for thousands of years are activating. And he also talked about Antarctica, and that's very important. Antarctica warming up. So this was back in December 1st when he gave that interview. So this is just the transcript. I just wanted to emphasize that these craft or these arcs that are buried under the surface of the moon, also Antarctica, are being activated, and more about that shortly. But there's the source for that if you're interested. Other sources talked about the arrival of the Intergalactic Confederation, or aka the Seeders, or the 24 civilizations, different names, but referring to essentially the same thing. And of course, Elena Danan, for those of you who haven't heard of her before, I have discussed her in previous webinars. My exopolitics.org website has a number of stories discussing her testimony. She's a former French archaeologist that worked for 20 years. The French space agency tried to recruit her because they recognized that she was also one of these contactees, and she said no to that, and she instead chose to go down the path of developing her abilities as a shaman, as a druidess. And so she's developed those abilities and has been transmitting messages from a member of the Galactic Federation of Worlds, Thorhan Eredion. So this is one of the messages she transmitted from Thorhan concerning the arrival of this intergalactic confederation of, 24 civilizations. So this is what she, this is the message that she received on October 10, 2022. I'm sorry, that should be 2021. So this is what she said. The fleet from the Intergalactic Confederation has arrived in this star system. Their ships will be stationed around Jupiter for a while until further notice to move nearer to Earth's orbit. So this is actually from Thorhan, transmitted through Elena. The personnel and logistics are welcomed on the Ashtar outpost. And that's very interesting because when she put out this information, not long after that, Courtney Brown got the Farsight Institute to do a remote viewing of the Ashtar Command because he was getting information like this saying that there's an Ashtar Command facility on the floating in the atmosphere of Jupiter. He just wanted to check it out. And his remote viewers nailed it. Indeed, there is. The Ashtar Command does have a floating city suspended high in the atmosphere of Jupiter. So that was confirmed by the remote viewers of the Farsight Institute. So it goes on, Thorhan goes on. High officials are staying at the Council of Five facility on the moon Ganymede. So this facility is on Ganymede as well. They come to evaluate the result of our common work regarding to the dismantlement of the Dark Alliance and collaborate together with the Galactic Federation of Worlds a course of action for the next step. So the Dark Alliance, Draco Reptilians, the Orion Consortium, the Deep State, and those groups. So here's a description of the spacecraft that were coming into our solar system according to the information that Elena got from Thorhan, and she says that she was able to see these craft because the way she communicates with Thorhan is aided by a technology, a brain implant that was put into her early in life that enables her to see visually what Thorhan is seeing. So she says these are the craft that she saw. You can see cigar-shaped craft. You can see very big flying saucer-shaped motherships that kind of like have this ovoid shape. And some of the beings, humanoid beings, and some very tall human-looking, or humanoid-looking beings that are hairless. So this is the information from Elena Danan about the arrival of the extraterrestrial seeders, and that they are here, and the arcs that were left behind are activating because of their arrival. So there's another source, James Gilliland, who I've known since 2006-2007. He's actually been working with different extraterrestrial groups for over three decades now. He also was getting information about the arrival of these extraterrestrial fleets around 2021. So there's a video clip or from an interview I did with James where he talks about their arrival. So we'll just play that now.
What's happening in space? I mean, I've been hearing a lot about some fleet that's arrived recently that's parked around Ganymede and Jupiter. Do you know anything about that that you can share?
Well, they said, they told us there was 500 ships, very large ships coming in. And they also told us that there was two that were going to be very active here on the Earth. They're going to make their presence known. And as part of the disclosure and to help out with the disclosure. And they're also doing work as well. And they're doing a lot of work on the other dimensions and working with us through frequencies and in our dream states and things like that to help clean up the planet. So there's this huge planetary liberation process going on.
So that's James on the arrival of these extraterrestrial fleets. Just It's very helpful because it gives us another source, independent, telling us that something truly momentous is happening right now in our solar system. And of course, you know, we're not getting that from the mass media, which is probably not a great surprise to many of us. Now, yet again, we have another source. This is Alex Collier, who has done a number of webinars, and I got to do an interview with him where he answered some questions about the arrival of these extraterrestrial fleets. And he said that actually Ganymede and Jupiter is a common destination for these extraterrestrials, that they've been doing this for thousands of years, that Jupiter and Ganymede is the first point of entry. Like, you know, for decades, I mean, up until, say, the last 20, 30 years, if you wanted to enter the United States, you would arrive by boat at Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty and so forth, and that's how that was the first port of entry into the United States. Well, similarly, Ganymede performed that function for our entire solar system and continues to perform that function. So he talks about these ancient extraterrestrial structures that are on Ganymede. And this precisely matched the information I got from my Army source, JP, who was saying that US Space Command was leading multinational meetings, or multinational missions, to Ganymede, and that they were being exposed to advanced technologies there, and that this was something that was eventually going to be disclosed to the rest of humanity. So now we get to the space arcs that are activating all over the Earth and on the Moon, that these 24 civilizations left these giant arcs with the advanced technology that would benefit humanity, that these arcs had multiple functions, and I'll go through the different functions, and I identify four functions later on as I get to the end of the webinar. I'll go through each of the four functions, but one of these functions was to be a repository of advanced technologies that would benefit future generations. So when you would have the seeding of a new civilization, these technologies would be there to be shared.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.